So welcome to the Friday talk, morning talk, and I was going to mostly talk about how this meditation retreat and all that you've learnt here and practiced here, how it will meld into what happens afterwards when you leave the real world and go into the fake world. You know, there's a lot of truth to that, because this always feels the most reality, to me anyway, when you're living in nature, when you're trying not to add too many things to your world, and you're trying to sort of experience the cold and experience the warmth. There's one thing which I kind of noticed, I may be wrong, but because, you know, when I was growing up, we really had heaters, but not too many of them, and sometimes it was really cold. And we didn't have too much. And sometimes you would fall over as a kid when you're playing soccer, and you'd have all the cuts and bruises, and you'd always will get sick sometimes. But getting that sickness early on in your life, that actually gave you the antibodies to be able to cope with any sicknesses later on in life. If we overprotect, especially our kids, and overprotect ourselves, then sometimes it weakens us, if you get that idea. And so that's one of the reasons why living in the real world, it's part of the real world to be sick, say. And that's one of the reasons you've heard me say this so many times. If any of you go to the doctor and you've got pains here, aches there, you feel you're dying, what should you say to the doctor? Doctor, there is something right with me. I'm sick again. Because sickness is part of the real world. It's part of having a body. We're getting realistic to the nature of our lives. And sometimes you get disappointed that your boss promotes somebody else instead of you. Welcome to the real world. But anyway, with promotion, now honestly, I've just given so many talks in Singapore, and they're really keen on being promoted. And I just ask them, challenge them. What happens if you get promoted? You get more stress, more people you have to look after. You do get an increase in salary, but it's never enough. No matter how much you increase the salary, you can always do with some more. And you have to work harder. Is it really worth it? Or would it be better not to get promoted, but ask to get relegated, to do a simpler job? You won't get as much money, but you know how to live simply. You have less stress in life. You can go home earlier because you don't have to worry about anybody else. And you don't have the pressure on you. That's one of the reasons why that was one of my biggest mistakes. Is becoming abbot of this place. I had it nicely figured out that had Ajahn Chakra was the abbot, and I could be number two. We called it slipstreaming. Or another way of putting it, the car in the front gets all the bugs on the windscreen. The car going behind has a much easier time. So I always thought that would be the very best. So even out in the world, you learn a lot of things here. Do you want to be promoted and have more status and more worries and more more money, but less time? That's another thing I always wondered about, that people would always, economies were going good in Australia and many other places I visited a few years ago. But they'd always complain they didn't have enough time. They didn't have enough time for themselves. They didn't have enough time to visit their loved ones and their friends. They found it hard to get time to go on a retreat. They didn't have time to meditate at home. So they were wealthy in the sense of had enough money in the bank, but they didn't have enough time to pursue that. And so that's one of the reasons why at that time when economies were booming, you know, you see that people, what they miss most of all is time. And then what happened? There was COVID. So you couldn't go to work. And then, you know, sometimes you couldn't get as much pay. And you had much more time, but not enough pay. And then people complained about that. And I thought, what a wonderful event it is when less people were working, you couldn't go anywhere, you had more time. And how did people use it? It would be wonderful if they had come onto enough retreats and they used that time in order to practice their meditation. Or learn some interesting things they liked about life, or just started a garden in their backyard, or whatever. Do something which they liked to do, rather than they had to do because it was good for their career. When I said that, you know, I was like the nuns who were rebellious, I like you who are rebellious too. Because being rebellious means you're kind of thinking for yourself. It's one of those sayings which I read somewhere else, but then I took it on board, and I think it's one of those things which kind of inspires me in my life. When everybody thinks the same, no one thinks at all. So, I mean, what is the reason for your life? If you think the same as everybody else, then you're not really thinking, you're not really getting any insight at all. You're just following the path which other people follow, not because you think it's right, because it's kind of easier in the sense that no one criticizes you. So if you go home and people criticize you because, what have you been doing the last 9 days? I haven't seen you. And you say you've been meditating. What the heck are you doing that for? Life is short. Enjoy it. There's so many places to visit. At this point I always say, have you seen the Great Wall of China? You don't need to, because you just go over to Bodhinyana. You see the Great Wall of Bodhinyana, that's pretty long. And that's long enough for you. Have you seen Niagara Falls or Victoria Falls? No. We can see Serpentine Falls. And if that's too small for you, that's too far for you, go in the shower. That's a waterfall. I mean, in Singapore, the Singapore people are very proud of the Changi Airport with the biggest indoor waterfall in the world. Yes, that's only size. Why don't you go in the shower and see that? It's not as big, but it's still an indoor waterfall. And you don't have to pay anything for it. So why do people like going to see those things? Well, have you seen the Grand Canyon? You don't need to see the Grand Canyon. After a heavy rainfall, just go and see some of the erosion we've got here as well. Because sometimes we believe what other people say. And these places become tourist attractions. Why? Because other people say it's beautiful. That's one of the reasons why, many years ago, that when we went, I think I mentioned this to someone in the retreat interviews, that when I went to India for the pilgrimage there, one of the places we went to see was, I don't know why, because people just wanted to see it, it was close by, was the Taj Mahal. Have you seen the Taj Mahal? You're very lucky. Because I wasn't a tourist, I was a monk. I was just sitting there and just looking at that monument and just asking myself, what is beautiful about it? Why is it beautiful? I was challenging our perceptions of beauty. And that was actually when I couldn't really find anything which signified it as beautiful. What is beauty? For that place, it's because other people said it was. So many people said it was beautiful They just believed that and followed it. And so I like the idea of rebelling a little bit and seeing what you find is beautiful. See what you find is worthwhile. And in your life, when you leave this place, how you want to live your life. What's important for you? You don't have to follow what other people said, what other people did. This is your life, and you want to try and make the best use of it for yourself and others as you possibly can. And that degree of confidence makes your life much, much more interesting. You're not just following old beaten paths. And even in your contemplating, not thinking, these days I always prefer to call this exploring. I never got to the last four stages of Anapanasati, and sometimes people translate that. How do you translate it? Like, you know, contemplate sort of impermanence, giving up, fading away, cessation. Are you thinking about that? Imagine, that's after you come out of a jhana. How can you think about that? No way, you're just far too still. Contemplating, that's a bit closer. But what is contemplation? I prefer the idea of exploring. You have, say, anicca, something there that's now gone away. You hold it in front of you and let the mind explore it. Not in words, not in ideas, but just give it that freedom to explore. And my definition of that insight, I mentioned it before, you just hold something up. You know, the old, what is this? It's a very good exercise because it's something you can do. You can, something can teach others when they ask, what have you been doing? Be looking at a water bottle and finding out it's far more than a water bottle. Finding out some of the things in your life are far more than what you've been told they are, or you've been taught they are. You look at it and you find all sorts of different ways of looking at it and making use of it. And that makes life just so fascinating. I don't know, there was a movie many years ago, and I think I'd just become a monk when it came out, but then somebody said I had to look at it, so they've recorded it for me, and that's the Gods Must Be Crazy video. They said it was religious because it had gods in it. I don't know if you remember that. How many people remember that video? Okay, quite a few of you. It was just some pilot flying over some, was it the Kalahari Desert? And he just had a Pepsi Cola, a can of Coca-Cola or something, and threw the can out the window. And it, I don't know if it fell upon this African tribesman, lived a very simple life. But you know, there was something he'd never seen before, like a tin can. Or it was a bottle, wasn't it? A bottle. Yeah, a bottle. And so he had a bottle. He'd never been told the use of it. So he used it for all sorts of interesting things. And his wife would use it as a rolling pin. He didn't have a rolling pin. But then sometimes he used it for hit his wife on the head, or his wife hit him on the head, I forget what. That's not a very good use. But nevertheless, it was an example of somebody who had never been taught anything, being able to see things in a totally different way. And you know, there's some use for that idea. I never found out exactly the name of this monk, but many years ago in some village in Thailand, these are all Thai stories because I lived there for such a long time, and I amassed these stories. This kid, when he went to school, he only had 4 years of school, he went into grade one, and this kid, after 1 year of grade one, failed. I'm not sure how you can fail grade one. Maybe your stick people drawings wasn't accurate. I know plasticine wasn't good, I don't know. But anyway, the teacher said, no, I cannot pass you. So he had to repeat grade one. Has that ever happened in Australia?
No.
No. Singapore, anyway. But anyway, so failed grade one. And then did it again. All his friends went up to grade two, and he had to do grade one a second year. And he failed again. 2 years failing grade one. And then they gave him one more chance. And after 3 years, he failed grade one the third time. This was just a village life. You know, they didn't realize that he needed some special sort of teaching assistance or something. So they just, he was hopeless, he couldn't go to school. And his parents thought, crikey, so that's stupid. We can't even trust him to look after the water buffaloes. What can we do with him? You know, some people are like that. You know that many years ago, there was this Vietnamese comedian lived in Melbourne. I won't say his name now, but apparently he said something about his upbringing. When he was small, he went to school, and when he came home, he asked his parents, IQ. What does that mean? Some of the kids in school have been talking about IQ. What does that mean? And his father said, well, it's a measure of your intelligence. If you've got an IQ of about 120, you're pretty smart. You may go to university. 140, you probably will go to university. You're really intelligent. Most people have an IQ of about 100. That's the average. IQ of about 80, you're going to struggle to get a job and survive in this world. And if you've got an IQ of 60, you're so stupid, you probably won't even be able to tie up your own shoelaces. And this Vietnamese boy said, oh, that explains why most Australians wear thongs. Well, I'm an Australian, I don't want to say that. Don't say that in an Australian pub, you might have a fight. You wouldn't go to a pub, obviously. But anyway, where was I going with this?
The child who didn't go to grade two.
Oh, that's right, yes. Thank you. That wasn't me. But what they did in Thailand, if somebody couldn't pass their school and they were pretty hopeless, you know what they did? Send them to the monastery. So this little fellow was ordained as a novice monk in this monastery. And you've got to give it to those abbot monks in the village monasteries. They may not sort of do much meditation, but they do a good service to the community. And this man was just so patient with this boy, always trying to teach, you know, just some chanting, because we all had to do some chanting, and just doing the Namo Tassa. That took months. After the boy learned Namo, what's the next word? Tassa. What was that first word again? He really did have learning difficulties. So even that monk, his patience soon ran out, and there was only one other place to send that little boy to: the forest monastery. We don't really have to do much chanting, not as much as in the village monasteries. So they sent him to the forest monastery, and there the teacher gave him a simple meditation technique. He soon got into really deep meditations, and soon became another one of the enlightened beings. His mind was so simple. He didn't sort of have this inner commentary where thinking in the terms of words. He had inner silence most of the time. So if any of you have any children who the school says have learning difficulties, now you know where to send them. We have another enlightened nun. You send them to Dharamsala. But what it was just showing just how that stillness the silence, not thinking. You'll be able to, even when you want to, get insight. You have it in front of you. You don't think about it, you explore it. It's almost like you let the thing teach you, rather than trying to find out what it means. It's more passive, just like the meditation. You don't do anything. You let the breath come to you. You let the wisdom come to you. You let the insights come to you. You don't go seeking for them. And that is one of the reasons why, at the end of a retreat, people think, oh my goodness, it's going to end soon, so I've got nowhere, what should I do? You'd be surprised that after the retreat is finished, when you go back home, you know, you have what they call like an hour to kill. You got some free time. And so you get up early in the morning. And so you don't have to go get ready for work yet. You sit down and meditate. And you'll be surprised how many of those meditations are really, really, really awful. You didn't expect me to say that, did you? And now some of them are really, really good. This is one of those things I haven't really said much. I did actually mention, but not really fully. Just how, on this retreat, whether you like it or not, you've been trying way too hard. You think you haven't. You know, and every time, you know, you think, oh, just my body says I need a rest, and you go and have a rest. I don't know how many of you feel guilty about that. Even I kept on saying, no, listen to your body. I should have said this earlier to encourage more rest. And that is a very, very, very famous story of Ananda's enlightenment. If you've been on one of my retreats before, you've heard this before. But this is a true story of Venerable Ananda, the Buddha's attendant, who was with the Buddha for 25 years. And because he was with the Buddha for such a long time, he had heard so many of his talks and instructions. So many that after the Buddha passed away, and Ananda still wasn't enlightened, nevertheless, when the other members of the Sangha decided to have a meeting to collect all the teachings of the Buddha as a whole, and that's where... Is that where the Tripitaka came from?
Sutta.
Ah, thank you. Not the Tripitaka. At that time it was the Dvipitaka. Only two. The Vinaya and the Suttas. All the traditions say the same. So anyway... they wanted a couple of monks, they wanted Ananda to join in, simply because he'd heard so much, even though he wasn't fully enlightened. So he was invited. A meeting of 500 enlightened arahats, and actually a meeting of 499 plus one Ananda. He wasn't enlightened yet. So imagine how he must have felt. Imagine if tomorrow morning, at the last talk, I made the announcement that everybody in this retreat had got enlightened, except for you. How would you feel? Really unfair. So, Ananda, the night before the big meeting, he really got himself together and decided he would meditate all night. No sleep, no messing around, his last chance to go for it. Enlightenment or bust. Be careful. Because every time I've seen someone do that, it's always bust. Even after the very first Waisak I went to, this was in Cambridge, I was so inspired after hearing these amazing talks and the Buddha's enlightenment. And I decided, I heard this part of one of the talks, the Buddha, before he was enlightened, made his resolution. as he sat under the Bodhi tree, even though my blood dries up and my bones turn to dust, I will not move from this spot unless I have experienced full enlightenment. He made that resolution. He wasn't going to move unless he was sure he was fully enlightened, no matter how long it took. I was really impressed by that. That's how stupid I was. So I went back to my room afterwards. I got out my meditation cushion. I sat down. Well, look, I was the Buddha, and I had a better education than he did. If he could do it, surely I could. I've been a Buddha for about 6 months. And I had many things to do in my life. I was busy. I wanted to get enlightenment out of the way so then I can go out and get married and start a job or something. That's how little I knew. So anyway, I sat down. My maximum meditation time was usually about 30 minutes, 25 minutes usually. And I sat down and said, it was a Waitsak day. Even though my blood all dries up. I was serious. Even though my bones turn to dust, I will not move from this cushion until I get full enlightenment. I'm serious. Serious and arrogant and stupid, you know. I made it to 40 minutes. It's a PB, personal best. And at that time, oh, my bones really hurt. My body was in so much pain. I had no choice. I couldn't stand anymore. And I opened my eyes. 40 minutes had gone past. And my blood was still flowing. It had not dried up. My bones hadn't turned to dust yet. And even worse, I certainly was not enlightened. But you know, sometimes you do those things. And I admit it. You know, sometimes you push, think you're going to be fully enlightened. There's another monk, I know he's still a monk, a very nice monk. Not here, but over in another country. And he decided to do something similar. He said, okay, let's come on, let's do this. It's a Waitsak night. And he was going to meditate all night without moving, without even changing his posture at all. And he did it. You know, just before the sun went down, he got in a posture and he got himself comfortable and made a resolution. He will not change his posture until the sun comes up. Not even adjust it slightly. Sit like this and stay like that. In the morning, when he sort of came out of meditation, we had to take him to the hospital. Double knee reconstruction. It isn't funny saying that story because to try and make sure other people don't do some silly stuff like that. It's not just endurance or willpower. It was always be wisdom, power and kindness. But I tell those couple of stories, so don't you do that. And you'll find just how the mind does change slowly. It is just, I did mention, I think in one of the earlier talks, about planting a garden. It takes years for that garden to grow. I don't know if you've ever seen any photographs of this place, Jhana Grove, when it was first built. There was so much clay under the ground here. It took a long time to be able to, you know, to grow the grass and grow a garden and grow the bushes and trees. And now, you know, it doesn't look nothing like those first year of when we built this place. The garden grows, but slowly. You can't kind of import a garden, just plonk it in, and it takes time. And it's the same also with something like Bodhinyana. It was about, how many years ago? Oh, 1991, Amanda, so 89, we had a big bushfire here. 91, okay, thank you. There was a big bushfire here, some of you may remember that. I mean, a really big one, a crown fire. And I remember just, I thought that all the buildings in Bodhinyana Monastery would be destroyed. It was that strong. And even going, that nothing, hardly anything was destroyed except for the trees. I remember just going there for the first time. We had to evacuate. I would have been burnt to death if I'd have stayed in there. It was just very dangerous. So anyway, we evacuated. When I went back there to investigate to see, when you went to the front gate of the monastery, you could see the whole monastery, right to the furthest part of the monastery. There was no bushes. There was no green at all anywhere. That had all been destroyed. You could see everything there. It looked so different than how it is now. I wish I had some cameras to be able to take those shots. Just standing, you could see the whole monastery. Nothing was impeded. But now, after so many years, you know, all the grass and the bushes and stuff all come back again. It takes a while. It grows slowly. And just like your meditation, your mindfulness and kindness and your wisdom start to grow. You don't know how fast they grow. And if you try and make them grow fast, they usually kill everything. You just have to have this wonderful patience. But one thing which encourages you, that you do see things grow slowly. But they're growing. And that is very encouraging. There was many years ago, I was still a lay meditator, and I was talking with one of these friends who just happened to be French. That's the only thing I remember, don't know his name, just having a cup of coffee. He was a meditator and he said, "How's your meditation?" I said, "Well, I'm not doing much these days." That's after about second year or third year of meditating. "Yeah, I do it when I've got time, but it wasn't really important to me." And he said, "Why?" And I said, "I'm not really getting anywhere." True story about me. And then he said, "Are you sure you're not getting anywhere?" "Yeah, I think so." And he told me what he used to do. After the end of every meditation, before he'd open his eyes and come out of his meditation, he'd ask himself or inquire how he had changed just in that half an hour or 1 hour of meditation. "Am I more peaceful? Am I more calm? Am I more kind? More alert? Is my body feel more relaxed?" Important questions. He said, "Yeah, maybe he didn't experience any nimittas or jhanas or whatever, but he certainly was more calm, felt much better, more aware, more kind, after just ordinary meditations." And he said, "Because you just take that meditation time for granted, you think it's not working. That is one of the reasons why you can't see the progress you're making. The progress is made slowly. So you have to actually look for it." And of course, once I started doing that, I did notice every meditation, even meditations before I thought were bad, they were still much better than not meditating. And I could see progress there. And that encouraged me. And of course then there became a few meditations which were obviously really good and fun. And obviously had benefits to them. You know, really clear physical benefits and mental benefits. And that encouraged me even more. The point was, even ordinary meditations, if you look, you can find something good has happened to your body and mind. You know, sometimes when people say that Ajahn Brahm, something you said or something the other monk said or something the nuns said had changed their life, it's not as if you say something then, "Yay, I'm changed, I'm healed, I'm enlightened, thank you." Some of those words, they get in there and it takes a while for them to reprogram your mind and for you to see things in a totally different way, which doesn't cause so much suffering anymore. It takes a time. And so that time of growth, it does not stop tomorrow when the meditation retreat finishes. That growth carries on. But anyway, back to Ananda. I like going off on tangents because I'm rebellious too. So Ananda, he meditated all night, watching his breath come in, watching his breath go out, breath come in, breath go out. All night he meditated. When the dawn came up, still as unenlightened as he was when he started, really, really kind of, not really depressed, but disappointed. And he knew that the following morning, in about an hour or two's time, he'd have to face all his friends and colleagues, all fully enlightened, and he wasn't. But what can you do? He tried his very best. So he decided, well, look at the time, maybe I've got an hour and a half. I'll take a nap first. And so he went to his room to take a nap. And then just before his head hit the pillow, he was fully enlightened. That's where his enlightenment experience happened, when he was going to bed. So if you've tried all these other ways to become enlightened, and that hasn't worked, try the Ananda method of enlightenment. Well documented, and everybody knows it worked for him. So you know what he did next? He enjoyed his, you know, enlightenment, post-enlightenment experience, the afterglow of enlightenment, the after, more than a glow. And he decided to arrive late. So the 499 fully enlightened beings were in this big hall. Ananda hadn't arrived yet, so they locked the door. They locked the doors of the hall so no one else could disturb them. And then just after they locked the doors of the hall, Ananda, the new Arahat, came in through the keyhole. He had psychic powers now. So a ray of light coming through the keyhole. Ta-da! I added the ta-da. It's called making an entrance. And of course, all his friends were so pleased. And their, you know, their good friend Ananda was now fully enlightened. And so he took a prominent part in reciting everything he knew the Buddha had taught for the gathering together of the Dhamma, and that was forming the Sutta Pitaka as we have it today. So anyway, the most important part of that is how he became enlightened. There's another story of how people become enlightened, but please, I'll only tell this if you promise me you won't follow this path. That was this nun. I think it was 7 years she'd been a nun. How long have you been a nun? Anyone 7 years? Oh.
Eight.
Hey, okay, you've gone past this, so it should be okay. 7 years she'd been a bhikkhuni, and never once did she have anything to even become close to peace or comfort or contentment. She tried everything, nothing worked. So after 7 years of hard meditation and contemplation or exploration, whatever you call it, she decided she had a choice. She could disrobe or take this other option, because it was just nothing was working for her as a bhikkhuni. And then she thought about disrobing. But then she said, if I disrobe, I would have to go back to the three crooked things. If you've been reading things like the Terigata and know the idioms of Buddhism, you'll remember what those three crooked things are. So if any of the bhikkhunis disrobe, you have to go back to the three crooked things. I didn't make this up, this is what's in the Terigata. The first crooked thing you go back to is the broom to sweep the house, like housework. And she didn't want to go back to housework, not the crooked broom. And the second crooked thing was the ladle, which you make the curry with, like the cookery. She didn't want to go back to that. And the third crooked thing was the husband. I've had enough of three crooked things. So she took the other option. This is why I said, please don't do this. She got a length of rope, you know, from the monastery storeroom. She went into the forest. She climbed a suitable tree, tied one end to the tree trunk of the rope and the other end to her neck. She was going to commit suicide. And it's called one way of letting go, but fortunately for her, that just as she was about to jump off, just in the nick of time, really in the nick of time, she became enlightened. That was a close one. Why? Because she's, for those moments as before, she wasn't doing anything, she was really letting go. She was stopping, giving up trying, letting things go. The first time she had stopped trying to attain anything. And that's her mind became peaceful. She wasn't chasing the carrot anymore as a donkey. She stopped and the carrot came right towards her. Do you understand? So sometimes you think, oh, I'll just, retreat's over, what's going to happen? You'd be amazed at some of the insights and experience which happen after the retreat. It's like everything you've learned here and everything you've been chasing, when you go back home you think, well, if I can't do it there, there's no way I'm going to do it here at home. But you stop and you find the carrot comes straight into your mouth. So don't be too disappointed. Number two, one of the other things which I missed, only a quarter of an hour to go. One of the other things which I've been telling a few of you in the question time or in interviews was when you do have a problem in the meditation, you're always, you know, either trying too hard, or when you let go you fall asleep, or you really let go, and then, but when you get to things like nimittas, then you start, you know, working on them, trying to hold them. What do you do when you do get some of these problems in the meditation which keep on coming up at a certain stage in your meditation? And this is where I taught many of you, but I want to share it with everybody in this morning talk, about programming your mindfulness. That's the way I call it. How that works is that you have a problem, such as if a nimitta comes up, you get excited or you get afraid. If that once a nimitta comes up, that's a very deep meditation experience. If a nimitta comes up and then you find yourself getting excited and you try to stop it, even that degree of effort will ruin the whole meditation. You go back to square one again. You can't at that stage tell yourself, don't get excited, it's okay. You shouldn't be saying anything to yourself. So how can you solve that problem? And the programming of mindfulness means at the very beginning of the meditation, you sat down, you're reasonably comfortable, and then you tell yourself, if a nimitta comes up, I will not get excited. If a nimitta comes up, I will not get excited. If a nimitta comes up, I will not get excited. In your own words, not too long, and repeat it 3 times. And listen as best you can. Pay as much mindfulness as you can. And then forget it, discard it. Don't even try to remember it. Because it's already been programmed into you. And then, it's amazing how that works. You know, then you're having a good meditation limiter comes up, and normally you get excited. But subverbally something comes up and says, no. The virus, the antivirus works. And you can get past that hindrance. The point is, if you try and be even more complicated than that, at that stage, the whole thing gets destroyed. You have to give that information at the beginning. And it's kept, stored, to be used at the right time. And that means that programming of mindfulness can overcome some of those deep hindrances which only occur in those deep meditations. And you can also use that for when, you know, you have to meditate. I think this is where I did tell you it before. You want to meditate for an hour and a half, and then you find that, you know, you have to come out because it's lunchtime or something. So what you do when you start meditating, I must come out of meditation by 11 o'clock, lunchtime. I must come out at 11 o'clock. I must come out at 11 a.m. Make sure you get the right a.m. or p.m. because you don't want to come out of meditation an hour before midnight and expect some lunch. Make it precise and just clear and then forget about it. It's amazing just how well that works. And if you, again, a thing I did ask you, please, if you haven't done this before, when you get up tomorrow morning, whatever time you decide to get up, just tell yourself, your mind, I will get up at 5 a.m. I will get up at 5 a.m. I will get up at 5 a.m. Slowly, carefully, meaningfully. And it's amazing how well that works. You wake up at 5 o'clock. So that programming of mindfulness is very powerful. And as I mentioned already, I've been programming your mindfulness for the last 8 days. Telling you what to do when these things come up, limiters come up, and pain comes up. That's why you're a teacher. That's what teachers do. And I'm so quite explicit about this and quite clear about it. So if there's any problems, a lot of times you'll be meditating and something happens, like what I used to do. Sometimes I'd be meditating and some amazing things happens and you find a solution to it. And afterwards say, where did that insight come from? And then I'd trace it back and Ajahn Chah told me that years ago. But it's stored somewhere in your mind, ready to come up when it's really needed. So that is actually why we teach like this. And so please, at the end of the retreat, don't think, oh, Ajahn Brahm, you always talked about nimittas and jhanas, and I just couldn't even watch one breath. My best practice was half a breath. And I say, I don't mind that, because those teachings have been programmed into you. And if they're worthwhile, the right time, the right place, outside of the retreat, they come to fruition, and then it will work. And if you look back afterwards, where did that come from? It was either myself or some other really good teacher, and they told you that, and now you understood it, and put it into practice, and it worked. A good example, another example of that, is this lady who came to meditation retreats years ago. She's a bit getting old now. So she was coming to Bodhinyana Monastery with some food once, and her car, I think she must have been sleepy, because her car went off into the side gravel of Southwest Highway. She lost control of her car, it was quite high speed, and her car rolled. So, you know, she was in there just watching the car go upside down, you know, and she was inside of it. And She said to me afterwards, you know, the car was a write-off, but she was fine when she came out, no injuries. And she was so amazed at that, and she came and told me why. She'd heard me say for years, you know, let go, let go, let go. So when her car started rolling, that's what came into her mind. It was way too fast, you know, to think, what should I do now? Oh yes, Ajahn Brahm said I should do this. That was too fast. I don't know, I made a little bit of a wrong speech there. When I said my name, did you hear what I really said? If you want to, if you were listening, it would be on the tape recording afterwards. But it reminded me of that time when I gave a talk at Mercedes School in Perth. It was a Catholic high school in Perth. And the day afterwards, I just happened to be walking down St. George's Terrace, not far away from the school, and two of the schoolgirls were walking down the road, and they passed me. They said, oh, how are you? Gave a talk at our school yesterday. And I said, oh, I'm so amazed you remember me. And they said, we'll never forget you. How can you forget a monk whose name is Ajahn Brahm? There's an M on the end. But what I was just talking about before, that's actually that I forgot to put the M on the end. But it's nice, you don't have to worry about what people call you. And if they do something which they hope is going to upset you, I repeat it to everybody, and it's funny. It's what Ajahn Chah always taught me. If someone tries to abuse you or tease you or say something to you to try and upset you, the much better response is to laugh, because sometimes that diffuses the situation straight away. Okay, another story comes up into my mind. Years and years ago, you know, when we first started Bodhinyana Monastery, we were quite poor. So the only vehicle we had was an old combi van. Amanda, she must remember driving that a few times. And I remember just going on some appointment and going down Leech Highway. It had three lanes. And it was a really hot summer's day, so I had all the windows open. And we came to a traffic light, so we stopped. I was in the passenger seat, the window was wide open. And a car of young kids came to the traffic light right next to us. You know, about 19, 20-year-old young men, and they were shouting at me, hey, hey! And so I turned around to look at them. It was an open window, and they had a magazine. Playboy. They were young people, they were trying to tease me and upset me. Open this. And did I look? Of course not. Well, how did I know it was Playboy? Because someone else told me. They were just having some fun. And just as I burst out laughing as well, I thought it was really funny. Because I thought that's maybe what I would have done if I'd have seen a monk when I was young. Probably I wouldn't, because I was too refined. But anyway, when people try and upset you, you laugh. And so, you know, when the traffic lights changed, they went off, we went off, we waved at each other. But anyway, that's how to deal with, you know, any abuse. That's what Ajahn Chah always used to teach us. If anybody tries to abuse you, just, it's fun. Try and find something funny about it. And then it diffuses the situation. People can say whatever they want, but they can't make your life more miserable. Anyway, so I never got round to, what's I supposed to say? Okay. Oh, this is about dependent origination, dependent cessation. Oh my goodness. 6 minutes. what I will do is, the dependent origination, I said something about it when I mentioned that the flame and the candle. The flame is caused by the wick, the wax and the heat. I mention that because there's one other a wonderful lady in the time of the Buddha who became fully enlightened and became one of the best teachers of that time. And that was Padachara. Padachara. And this is also a nice story because any of you think, oh my goodness, I don't think I've got it together, you know, to become fully enlightened. You may have some trauma from the past. And Padachara had huge trauma. She lost her husband, her two children, and her parents on the same day. The whole family got destroyed. And I won't go into the whole story, but then she was so crazy that she came into the Jetavana monastery. She didn't know where she was going. She walked into there totally naked. And she was a young woman. And when she walked into that hall where the Buddha was giving a sermon, imagine a naked woman would come in that door right now. What would you do? Would you say, get out of here, there's a monk in here. You know, get out. And come in properly dressed. But a few people tried to chase her away. But the Buddha said, no, let her in. And one of the monks got one of his robes and wrapped it around her so she looked half decent. And the Buddha taught her Dhamma. It's one of the reasons why that sometimes in some of the talks people come in, you know, in a really weird state of dress. I remember only a few weeks ago, there was these three young ladies came to my talk in Nolamara Temple. And they were really, I think they had more bare skin than clothes on them. Honestly. And they were just going over to Northbridge afterwards. They decided to come to listen to a talk first. And they said, you know, that one of the reasons why they were coming to the talk before they went to some party in Northbridge, because they'd known me for a while, and they know that I wouldn't sort of object. I had some kindness and non-judgmental attitude. And they really liked the talk. And they enjoyed making contact. So anyway, not physical contact, I mean just saying hello. But anyway, I was just being kind to them. And just, that's one of the reasons why, you know, remembering what happened with Padachara. They're always that kind and open, let them come. So anyway, the Buddha taught Padachara, but later on, Padachara meditating, and after meditation, instead of actually contemplating Anicca, she was just watching the flame of the candle. Well, it was actually an oil lamp in those days. The wind came and blew the candle flame out, or the flame of the lamp out. And that was her enlightenment. What she saw, she could understand its meaning. And that was the end of all of her defilements. And she became this amazing teacher. If ever you read the Therigata, you'll find all these nuns having such a difficult time getting some deep meditation, having such a difficult time understanding the Dharma, even though they had lots of teachers there. But this nun, that she was so down to earth, so wise and compassionate, she had become one of these greatest of teachers in the time of the Buddha, Padachara, and that's how she became enlightened. That's what dependent cessation is. When you find out the cause of things, then when those causes disappear, then the result disappears. What's the cause of your mind consciousness? Nama rupa, objects of consciousness. When the objects of mind consciousness stop, then your consciousness ceases. It's not there anymore. It's not just in abeyance, like a TV screen. What happens when the program stops? The TV vanishes. That's an interesting type of television screen. But that's what it's like. When Nama Rupa, the objects of consciousness, cease, objects of all types of consciousness cease, so do consciousness. Consciousness, knowing, is not a permanent entity. It's not in abeyance waiting for you to turn on the electricity and make something happen. When there's nothing on the screen vanishes too. That's a little intro, a quick glimpse at dependent cessation. You're quiet now. No, it's not going to work. I'm not going to say any more. It's 9 o'clock. Sadhu! 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 Okay, it's the last day, as I mentioned earlier. If you haven't got enlightened yet, there's not much chance. So don't even try. And then you might all become enlightened.